Welcome to episode 16 of The Infectious Myths. Today, I'm pleased to have a very brave filmmaker as my guest, Joan Shenton. A couple of years back, Joan, along with her co-producer Andy Rice, made the film Positively False, Birth of a Heresy, a history of the development of the AIDS dogma and its early critics. And now they are in the process of releasing a very different film, Positive Hell, to film festivals. Before I get to Joan, let me remind you that you can email me with comments, criticisms, or suggestions for more guests at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyths, one word, .com. Please don't send brickbats. They sound like they'll hurt. And if you'd like to sponsor the show in any way, we should talk. Joan Shenton has many years of experience as a filmmaker doing medical documentaries for Channel 4 and other people through her company Meditel, but she ran into trouble when her films started questioning the HIV-AIDS dogma in the late 80s, early 90s, and for many years she was unable to work in her profession. The new film, Positive Hell, which you can find information about it at positivehell.com, is not a weepy story ending with the death of an emaciated man who fought the virus bravely but lost, with no mention in the film of the toxic drugs he took, but it's a story of hope, bravery, and survival in a corner of Spain known as Galicia. So Joan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David, and for those very nicely composed words.
Oh, well, you're welcome. They're true, and I could probably say a lot more about you. In this film, you found a group of, if I can summarize it, HIV-positive people who were all former addicts of heroin or alcohol, perhaps other substances.
Yes.
They all quit. If they took AIDS drugs, it was only for a short time. And yes, a couple of decades later, they're healthy and living life normally. So can you sort of fill in a little bit more about this group of
people?
That's
right. There's 27 years on, they are leading life normally. They were all intravenous drug addicts or alcoholics, as you said. And actually, two of them that I feature in the film never took any antivirals.
Right.
And two took them for a period of about 8 years of those 27 years.
Right.
I do have to tell you early on in this that one of the people I interviewed has sadly died, and that was Suso, and he was positive for 27 years. He died in February this year of lung complications.
Right. Yeah, that's sad when it happens when you get to know somebody in a film and then
I know.
Was he one who took the drugs back?
He never took any.
Mm-hmm. But lived 27 years with his
so-called
diagnosis. So back then, 27 years ago, the drug would have been AZT, right? That would have been
the only
drug.
But it wasn't readily available in northern Spain in those years, which was 87.
Right.
So they weren't all offered it, but they were sent to a unit called Proyecto Hombre, which was for drug addicts. And it so happens that that project was very successful at getting people off their drugs.
Okay. So stopping the heroin, and in some cases, that was it. You talk about a woman named Raquel.
Yes.
Who married a man named Pablo, and they had two children together. What's his status?
Excuse me. Well, Raquel actually had a child before she married Pablo. She had two daughters, right?
Right.
She had her first daughter when she was very, very young. I think she was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And the daughter was born positive. She was diagnosed antibody positive. And everyone said, look, you go and look after yourself, but don't worry about the baby because she'll probably lose the antibodies. So this was in, 87, I think.
Right.
So she went on to a follow-up clinic, and the baby, after 18 months, lost the antibodies that she had inherited, maternal antibodies. That little girl is now 27, and she's had 6 children.
Oh, my God.
Now, the other daughter, when she married Pablo, she had a second daughter. At this point, Raquel had been positive for 10 years and never taken any antivirals.
Right.
But because she was being followed up, the doctors said to her, look, you know, there's a danger to the fetus. You must take AZT.
It's kind of ironic since
AZT is
a drug that interferes with DNA synthesis.
That's right. They would think
that was good for the baby. But anyway, so
what? Exactly. Because of a risk to the fetus, I quote. So she took AZT, and the baby was born, and the baby was born antibody positive. But after 18 months, the second daughter lost the antibodies. And Raquel stopped taking AZT, and she didn't take it again because she was, she said she felt really, really ill. I mean, I have a little quote from her here, if I can find it in time. I have a quote from her saying, I've been HIV positive for 27 years. I've had 2 daughters, and with one of them I took AZT. Both of them became HIV negative after 18 months. They're both perfectly well. And then she says, I feel well like this. Over the past 27 years, I took antivirals for 8 years, and I'm never going to take them again because I feel well like this, not taking anything. I feel happy and full of life without taking any drug treatment. It's the treatment that, for me, over these years, 27 years, made me feel the most ill.
Did her daughter, her second daughter, take AZT, or was, I guess it's not the right
Yes, they gave the usual antenatal and postnatal AZT to her.
Right, so they both took AZT for that first year of the child's life. Now, I believe she also talked about having unprotected sex with Pablo for many years. I mean, it's not like they using condoms or something except when they wanted to get pregnant. And
he is
negative?
He's negative. He was followed up for about 15 years after they got married.
Right.
And he was always negative.
It must have been brave for him. I mean, given all of the propaganda about this deadly virus, to marry a woman who was HIV positive and have unprotected sex for her was a fairly brave thing to do in those days.
Yes, but he was also a drug addict. And he tested positive for on one test when he was much younger, and then negative after that, and never positive again.
Right. And perhaps I should say for our listeners that one of the challenges to doing this film was that I believe everybody in the film obviously speaks Spanish, but more importantly, none of them speak English. So the film has to use subtitles or translations for all of the people in the film.
Indeed, the whole of it's a 30-minute film now, and. Actually, I do take my hat off to Andy because he came with me to Spain, but he doesn't speak Spanish. So obviously I interpreted for him, but it was hard for him.
Right, right.
But they all loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a grand job. So.
Yeah, that's great. And you know Spanish because you grew up in Chile?
I did. I grew up in Chile and spoke Spanish before English, and I was very moved by a letter I received from Dr. Manuel Garrido, who runs the website called...
I want to talk about him.
Okay.
Go ahead. So this letter...
He runs the website called Superando el SIDA, Overcoming AIDS, and I was very moved because he wrote a letter to me saying... And I think you know about this, that he wanted to He was so moved by baby Rico's story of and the way he was forced to take AZT that the listeners may not all know about baby Rico's story, but you can give us a brief.
Sure. So back in the early 90s, the Nagel family adopted a child from Romania, I believe, and the child had been tested for everything in Romania and had specifically tested negative for HIV. But when the baby was brought to America, the baby tested positive for HIV, and therefore the parents were told to put the baby, Lindsay, on AZT, which they did for about two years. I believe the grandfather discovered something about Peter Duisberg, wrote to him, and Peter Duisberg wrote back immediately saying, stop the AZT. And by this time, baby Lindsay was suffering tremendously. He was not eating, was not gaining weight, was crying. It was quite horrible, and the parents were basically preparing for her death. They stopped the AZT, and baby Lindsay became a healthy, normal child. And I saw her in 2009 when she was 19, and she was a beautiful young lady at that point. But then a couple of years later, she got pregnant with her boyfriend, and the doctors insisted that the baby be drugged. And it was just a nightmare situation where the local public health authorities insisted that the parents, Lindsay and her boyfriend, go on Skype every day, Skype video, and the health authorities could watch them drugging the baby every day. And it's a very sad situation. So you said that Dr. Garrido wrote to about the Lindsay case?
Yes, he wanted his group to support the Nagel family, and he described what had happened to baby Rico as a public health politics of genocide.
Yes.
And he brought people together, and he thought it would be a very good idea if a petition was sent, drawing up a petition signed by a number of long-term survivors who'd been alive for over 27 years.
Right.
They were called non-progressors, or apparently the orthodoxy calls them elite controllers. And he wanted to send the petition to President Obama, the Human Rights Commission, the UN, and the World Health Organization, and also to attorney generals in many different countries around the world.
Right.
Now, I wrote back and offered support, but I said, do you know a lot of people who've been positive 27 years and more? And he said, oh, yes, a lot of them belong to my network here. I said, can you put me in touch with them? And he was enormously helpful.
And so was this how you sort of found out about this group of people in Spain? Because it was totally unknown to me until you started talking about it.
Yeah.
And how many people? You have about five in your film, but how many people is he aware of?
I think I really don't know that. It's about 30 that have lived that long and others less long. I mean, actually, he mentioned some numbers to me, but I haven't got them on me right now. Several hundred who are not wanting to take the medications.
Yeah, now let's talk a little bit about Dr. Manuel Garrido, because he's more than just a doctor who has advised his patients not to take AIDS drugs. But he himself, back 27 years ago approximately, was a serious addict, in his case a very bad alcoholic.
Yes.
And he's also HIV positive.
Yes, he is.
And so he has lived, he's taken his own medicine, or maybe I should say he's not taken the medicine, just like all the others, and he's also in good health.
Absolutely, and just to slip this in, he believes that if we want to make any progress in the AIDS dissident struggle, that it would be helped by people who are affected, like him.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's a lot of. I mean, you have to take somebody seriously who's not just telling people to do something, but has actually followed his own advice.
Exactly.
I mean, I always think of cancer doctors who tell their patients, you know, take chemotherapy, take radiation, take surgery, who have never experienced side effects of that.
Yeah.
I mean, in some cases that's not true, but in the vast majority of cases they haven't experienced their own medicine. And so he's taking the same risk as his patients in not taking the drugs when the medical establishment is saying you must take the drugs. And so he started pulling these people together. How did he find all of these people who were HIV positive and
there are several networks across Spain, and they don't all... There are some disagreements between them, as ever, in the dissident movement.
Right.
But he just decided to devote his time to it. He was in touch with Alfredo Embiid, whom he gets on with very well. Alfredo Embiid is a really pioneering dissident in Spain.
Okay.
You've heard of him, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And... Then he decided to set up his own website and got some help with the technical side of setting up a website. And he's really, really devoted to helping people. And they ring him at all hours of the day and night to get advice.
Right, right. Mm. And his website is Superando el SIDA, which in Spanish is Overcoming AIDS, ning.com.
Yes.
So if people want to find it.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like over the 27 years, a lot more people have come to him being diagnosed HIV positive and maybe having heard through the grapevine that there's a doctor who says you shouldn't take the drugs.
Yes.
And tried to get information from him.
That's right.
What was the response? Like, did some of these people talk about the response of their doctors when they told them that they were not going to take drugs or they were going to stop taking drugs? Did they talk about what happened then?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there was a man called Manuel, and he came from very nearby in Galicia, and he was very... angry with his doctors because they were trying to force him to take all the medication.
Right.
And he said, I'm not going to take 27 different pills a day, he said to his doctors. I'd rather die of AIDS than die of poisoning from pills. So he didn't take them, and he's been well ever since.
But his doctors were not happy.
Well, it's interesting. It would appear that in the early days in Spain, the doctors were not so, rigorous.
Yeah.
And they let people they let these young couples get on with their lives. For example, Raquel and Pablo were told by their doctor, she said she felt they were very lucky. He said, look, you know, don't worry about unprotected sex and protected sex. He said, just get on with your lives.
Mm. I guess things have become more dogmatic over time, because I can't imagine a doctor saying that today. But, I mean, Galicia in Spain was not exactly a hotbed of AIDS, so it probably wasn't getting a lot of attention.
That's right.
How did the serious drug problems in Spain start?
Well, I understand that there's this very big port there. Oh, gosh, you won't believe it. I can't remember the name of it, but Dr. Garrido lives in Cangas.
Right.
And there's this very big port in northern Spain. And in the post-Franco era, restrictions on drug importation somehow were more relaxed. And drugs just flowed in through northern Spain and were very, very cheap.
Like heroin. You're not talking about pharmaceutical drugs. You're talking about...
Heroin.
Heroin, yes.
Yeah. Was that your question? Sorry.
Vigo!
Okay. Well done.
Okay.
Yeah.
So drugs started to flow in, and Franco died mid-70s?
Yes.
So once Spain became a democracy, there was less tight controls, I guess, on...
That's what they told me. I mean, I haven't sort of researched this in depth about the post-Franco era, but this is what I'm told by the people I interviewed. And then, of course, they themselves were robbing pharmacies and getting hold of heroin and other drugs through the pharmacies.
Right.
So quite a list of drugs they took. There were, all the known ones.
Like opiates, anything that's similar to heroin, I guess.
Yeah.
So it sounds pretty desperate. What was the treatment system? And there's a lot of debate over the best way to treat drugs, but what kind of method did this treatment...
Well, I'm not familiar with how they did it, but it was actually a project funded by the church, the Catholic Church in Spain, and they had very good psychotherapists, I'm told.
Right.
And the psychotherapists had a very high success rate. I think the project still exists called Proyecto Hombre. Let me quote two lines from Manuel.
Yes.
He said, I started off smoking hashish. After hashish, we had already started on pharmaceutical products. And we started stealing from pharmacies. And then we started doing morphine, then opium, then on to laudanum, then amphetamines. And these were the kind of things we did.
So he was taking pharmaceutical drugs. Yeah, I mean, illegally, but
yes.
he wasn't doing heroin.
Heroin, yeah.
And I guess to a drug addict, I mean, there's no difference between a pharmaceutical drug and an illegal drug except the legal status. I mean, to them,
indeed,
they can get high. They don't
you
care.
Get high, you get high. And it's the same chemical, active chemical component.
Yeah, and the pharmaceutical industry keeps producing new addictive drugs. Like the latest one is, maybe not the latest, but one that's a big problem is OxyContin,
which was
developed for, severe pain.
Yeah.
And people found that they felt pretty good taking OxyContin, so now it's a huge addiction problem, destroying lives in the same way as a lot of other addictive drugs do.
Yep, that's right. Another tiny quote from Manuel. He said, everyone was very hooked to their drugs, meaning illegal drugs, I suppose, and whatever they'd stolen. And all this time, they went on testing people and giving them the AZT with Septrin Forte. It was like a time bomb, and people began to drop like flies.
Wow. And Septrin is a very potent antibiotic, which is given to HIV-positive people because it's believed that if they're sick, it's believed that they need something stronger than regular antibiotics, and if they're not sick, it's believed that they need it just in case that they're going to get an infection, so they'll give them Septrin. I think it's also called Ceftobactrim. So
yeah,
it goes under a lot of different names.
Yeah.
And it can also cause severe health problems like severe anemia, just like AZT can cause.
Yeah.
And AZT can also cause, in the longer term, it can cause cancer. So has there been any of the people who took AZT back those years ago come down with cancer?
Not that I know of. Not the ones I interviewed. I haven't. It's a question I could put to Manuel Garrido.
Yeah.
I tell you what, though. Manuel also says this. He says, I was on AZT and antiviral therapy for 8 years. But day by day, I started to notice something very strange. My right hand wasn't working properly. I lost sensation in the hand. I had headaches. I couldn't read. I couldn't sleep properly. Just a series of things that came on progressively that weren't right. They weren't right, and this seemed odd to me because I was leading a healthy life. I was walking every day, 12 kilometers. I was eating well and looking after my health. So then he gave them up.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because I remember talking to another Spanish former drug addict at a conference, and he had become very rigorous in his health regimen, like what he ate, what he drank. He was extremely careful in his life. So he'd gone from somebody who would stick anything into his arm He'd had a health crisis where he almost died, was tested HIV positive, told to go on the drugs, didn't go on the drugs, and then turned his life around so that he was much more careful in his daily life than somebody who'd never been a drug addict.
This is so true. And the thing that really shocked me, but I guess I should know this happens, was when Raquel just said to me, you know, I was 16 and I was injecting straight into my vein 3 times a day.
Yes.
3 times a day.
Yes. And then there was some AIDS doctor who years ago famously said that heroin is blessedly non-toxic. And maybe that would actually be true if heroin was produced by a pharmaceutical company.
Oh, if it were pure.
But what you buy on the street is probably a small percentage heroin and then a whole bunch of
awful unknown substances. Things like talcum powder and kerosene and all
sorts of things. I mean, all kinds of things, either to dilute the drug or because it's being produced under less than ideal circumstances, it's not, you know, there's lots of solvents or other things that get into the heroin that should have been removed. Anyway, so what is the status of the film now? It's completed.
It is completed, and we've sent it this week to 7 film festivals.
Okay.
Marbella, where our last film was nominated for Best Documentary.
Right.
Lucerne, which, the same story. And then Oaxaca in Mexico and a New York one. And actually, the trouble is that it costs quite a lot of money to send to these festivals. It's £50 or 100 a go.
Right, right.
To submit. But I've put out an SOS, I'm having a meeting with somebody this week who may be able to help support sending it to loads more festivals, because the good thing about sending it off is that it gets seen, you know,
right,
even if only by the jury. And
right,
then I obviously want to have a screening in London. But you know the story of what's happened to the last 2 screenings of AIDS films in London.
Yeah, why don't you describe that for our listeners, because you know it better than I do.
I don't know a lot about the one which Neville Hodgkinson and Dr. Gachetta, I believe, were going to be on the panel for, to do with a newspaper, because
the
I
Spectator,
seem to have been away at the time.
That was the Spectator newspaper that was going to have a showing of a film.
Yeah.
And
that was cancelled. And then we managed to have a private screening with about 150 people for Positively False Birth of a Heresy.
Mm-hmm.
But no press, and nobody picked up on our film at all. And then recently, Anne Blumenthal and Sono made a film, well, a few years back, called I Won't Go Quietly. And it's about 6 women who had been diagnosed positive and had huge problems because they wanted to breastfeed and some had their children taken away. Now, you've seen that film, David, and it was supposed to be screened at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies, part of London University.
Right.
And Anne flew over, and there was quite a lot of publicity because she employed a publicity agent to tell everyone about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was supposed to be on the panel with Mike Hersey and, with Mike Hersey. Anyway, we all turned up at SOAS that day, and people had come from far and wide to see it.
Right.
And we were told that it had been cancelled. And so the whole row broke out, which I won't take hours and hours telling. But it would appear that the students' union in SOAS had realized this was going to happen, and that some of them had probably links to a charity called Stop AIDS.
Right.
And also to a very anti-dissident and anti-denialist journalist called Ben Goldacre.
Oh, yes.
And that the story had got round that there was going to be a big demo. So the students' union took it upon themselves to tell the women's group who wanted to screen it, called Women for Women International,
right,
that it was far too dangerous. And the story is that the women's group say they were told it was cancelled, but the students' union says the women's group said it was cancelled.
Yes, everybody's running for the hills to avoid responsibility for what happened.
But what I find really worrying, and there's been an article in general, not in relation to this specific instance, recently about the power students' unions have over censorship of what is said on university campuses, because they're in charge of the rental of the rooms.
Okay.
And it's a very important matter which should be addressed.
Right. Maybe it's different in the UK. I remember I went to my local university here in Canada, the University of Calgary, with a friend.
Yeah.
And Stephen Lewis, who's very famous in Canada, he was a Canadian politician, but he got connected to AIDS because he worked for the Secretary General as his sort of, quote, AIDS ambassador in Africa. And
yeah.
It was always running around the country, running around the world, giving these talks about there's millions of people dying, and they're dying because you in the West are not giving enough money to buy drugs for them.
Yeah.
He was a huge pusher of drugs. He still is, although he's I think, in semi-retirement now. So we handed out a pamphlet which basically, you know, said that the drugs he's promoting have extremely toxic side effects.
Mm.
And we were marched off the campus by a very thuggish-looking guy who was the head of security, I guess, at the university.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the reason for it was because the university makes quite a bit of money from renting out halls to speakers. This was not a university event. It was somebody renting space at the university.
Ah, no, there's the difference, yeah.
Yes, and they want to protect the renters from any kinds of upset.
Well, no, it wasn't like that with us because these were rooms that were free to pressure groups from within the university.
Right, so it was a students group, but they're under the thumb of the students' union.
Yeah.
But one would think, like take your new film, that the world would welcome with open arms the possibility that at least some people who are HIV positive can live normal lives, you know, absolutely normal lives with no impact on their life from HIV without taking drugs. I mean, it would cost the world a lot less. The people who were affected would have better lives, not dealing with drug side effects and the trying to remember always which pill do I take at which time, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And yet, that's usually not the case.
No, we're just all called denialists and tarred with the same brush. But I'm hoping that this film will have a different reception. I'm very much hoping. And
yeah, so what was the reception to Positively
Pardon?
False? Your first film in recent, I shouldn't say your first film, your most recent film was Positively False, Birth of a Heresy.
Yes.
What was the reception to that?
Well, it was rejected from about 20 film festivals, right?
Wow.
And the two that accepted it nominated it for Best Documentary.
Yeah.
So it got a nom, if you see what I mean.
Right.
All the agents we took it to rejected it. And the broadcasters as well. We've actually recently had a request from Al Jazeera to view it. I have to follow that up.
Yes.
It wasn't so recent, actually. It was a little while back. But the thing is that there's this new film coming. The first film was more historical. It was a story about, in a sense, the AIDS dissident movement and the science, with a sort of sketch of the science behind each person's position.
Right.
And how the world had reacted to this news. I mean, first of all, as you know, we won a massive award through Channel 4. And the next thing is, you know, we're pilloried.
Right.
And now we've got this film coming out. And then, not wishing to plug my book, but just to mention that there is a fortunate coincidence that the reprint of my book with 21 updates is coming out in August.
So your book is also called Positively False.
This one's called, the book is called Positively False, Exposing the Myths Around HIV and AIDS.
Right.
And it's the 15th anniversary edition, David, and you have written, you've contributed to the updates.
Oh, okay. I had forgotten, but
you have.
You did ask me to write something, so I
yes,
did.
Yes, and thank you very much. So that'll all come out in August. And there's 21 different ones coming up, and we've got, I was just looking at the list of people. We have four doctors of medicine, two professors, and you are a doctor of science, aren't you?
No, I'm a bachelor of science.
A what?
I just have a bachelor's degree.
A bachelor's of science.
Yeah.
So there you go. I've got Dr. Nancy Banks, Dr. Roberto Giraldo, Dr. Irina Sajanova, Dr. Christian Fiala, Professor Helen Lauer, and Professor Bauer, and you, and a whole lot of others, journalists.
Okay. Okay. So you're going to try to put positive hell into film festivals. How can people help you get the message out about this new movie?
Well, it's funny. I definitely want to try to employ a publicity agent at a certain point. But for the first few months, I would like to see if we can get a positive response from the film festivals that we can use as leverage.
Right, right. If it's accepted into a bunch of film festivals, I guess that makes gives agents or other people a bit more courage to move forwards with it.
That's right. And I've never used a publicity company before, but Anne Blumenthal did for the screening of her film, and she said that they placed the information very well, and I'd like to do that with regard to the book to see if we can use professionals to place the information.
How did people donate to your efforts?
Well, you know the Immunity Resource Foundation website. There's a donations facility there through PayPal.
Okay, and that's immunity.org.uk.
Yes, that's the website with the archive of all the different films and stuff. And it has a blog that Mo Aziz is running.
Right.
And it's, it's on there. And then there's a website for the film as well. And we're going to create a website for the reprint of the book as well.
Oh, wow. So you're kind of busy, really.
Yes.
To say the least. Let's go back to the beginning of your career when you started doing films and, up to the point where you started to get into trouble about things. When did you make your first documentary?
Well, the first one was in 86, which was when my colleagues and I had been making programs about the danger of prescription drugs and ones that needed to be withdrawn, and we'd made two series called Kill or Cure for Channel 4. And then we thought, well, we won't touch AIDS because AIDS is being looked after very competently by everybody and it's a terrible thing. And and so then my researcher, Jad Adams, who's since written a book called AIDS, the HIV Myth. He went to America with Michael Verney Elliott, who was also working for Meditel, and they were looking at a story because Michael felt that gay men were being unjustly blamed for spreading AIDS.
Right.
And he thought there might be something to do with contamination of blood supplies coming through Canada in orange bottles, orange juice bottles. And so we were sort of looking into this, but they realized soon when they got there that they'd never be able to find the proof. It probably is true that Brazil was sending blood through Canada into America.
I wouldn't be surprised, because America has a privatized blood donation system.
And that was that was to be the story, called Bad Blood.
Yes.
And that this might be causing this syndrome in people of immune suppression.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But when they got there, they couldn't prove it. But then Jad read Peter Duisberg's article in Proceedings of the National Academy of Science.
Okay.
In which Peter, that was his first blast, in which Peter said, you know, it could be that HIV can't cause AIDS.
Which was a pretty big step against the medical establishment.
Yeah.
Deeply embedded to the dogma by that time.
That's right. So when Jad read it, he came back with Michael, and we had a meeting, and I put the idea to Channel 4 that we should make our film about Peter's theory, and we called it AIDS, the Unheard Voices, which was not just Peter's, but there were one or two other people who had different theories about AIDS that were not infectious.
Right.
And that was the first film. And to our absolute delight and surprise, and it was produced by Jad, we won the Royal Television Society Award for journalism.
Wow. But then things turned around.
And then we made the next one called The AIDS Catch. And that that actually was more specifically about Peter's work and his position on HIV. And that then the whole establishment came down on our heads, shortly followed by AZT Cause for Concern.
And now AZT, we should take a little pause here for people don't remember. AZT was approved in 1987 on the back of extremely suspect clinical trials with all kinds of funny things happened, and at least two people have written extensively about that, mostly John Lauritsen and also Lynn Gannett, who was a data who worked on the management of the data from the trial. But AZT was produced, or is produced, by basically a British company, which back then I think was called Burroughs Wellcome, is now GlaxoSmithKline.
I'm not sure who bought it, but the Wellcome Foundation, in England was Burroughs Wellcome in America, and then there's the charity called the Wellcome Trust, and I think they were bought by GlaxoSmithKline, but I can't remember now.
Yeah, I think the Wellcome Trust may still exist as a charitable organization, separate from GlaxoSmithKline. But yeah, I mean GlaxoSmithKline, I guess, owns AZT, except now it's off patent. So there seems to be more attention to other nucleoside analogs.
Mm.
And I mean AZT, people like Peter Duisberg criticized AZT because it is a nucleoside analog, which basically means that if you think of DNA, a chain of DNA as a chain of beads, it is a defective bead.
Yeah.
A thymidine, AZ, the T in AZT stands for thymidine.
Correct.
And every AIDS cocktail contains one, usually two, different nucleoside analogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for mothers and infants, still, AZT is the most popular drug to use.
Yeah.
I've never understood how a drug that interferes with DNA synthesis can be given to a mother or a baby.
It's
when
terrifying.
The baby is basically a mass of rapidly dividing cells. I mean, as a fetus or as a young infant, that's when you grow the fastest.
Yeah.
And so they didn't like you criticizing AZT?
Well, no. I mean, they threatened to injunct the program. Wellcome did, and Channel 4 stood by us. And the share
of
AZT dropped dramatically when our film went out. And then that film won the Medical Journalists Award. And by then, we'd had really hostile journalists, medical journalists, from the Independent newspaper and The Guardian, And they wrote articles saying we should never have been awarded that award, that it was criminal what we were saying, and that they should take the award back away from us.
Right. And then there was kind of a Star Chamber proceeding, I seem to remember.
Yes. Oh, goodness. There was. We were taken to a kind of Star Chamber, as you say, by the Broadcasting Complaints Commission, at least. The Terence Higgins Trust took us, and a journalist called Duncan Campbell.
Oh, yes.
And we fought our corner, and I always remember David Lloyd, who was our commissioning editor at Channel 4, who always liked blowing a raspberry at the medical establishment. He came out, and he said, "It's like winning a football match 9-0 and being told you've lost."
Yes, yes.
You know, we lost.
Right. And then when was that, about early 90s?
Yeah.
And what happened to your career as a video producer, documentary producer?
Oh, I completely couldn't get any commissions of any kind, so I decided to drop out, and I went to write the book in the Dominican Republic.
Mm.
Yeah.
The book Positively False.
Yeah.
And then you basically were not working in that area at all for many years.
That's true. I went and worked in a law firm as a clerk for 6 years. Yeah.
Yes, to make ends meet because you couldn't
pay the gas bills. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And so what? But then, some years later, you started, I believe, with the Immunity Resource Foundation website. So what sort of got you back into this whole thing again?
Well, I think it was always ticking over in the background, and I did have some support from two board members of Rethinking AIDS who allowed the archive to be kept, our big AIDS archive, together with Continuum magazine.
Right.
And so with that kind of basic support, I could go on. And it's incredible, really, because I was just thinking about that today. There were one or two times when I thought I'm going to have to just drop this all. But because I was just getting that fundamental, basic piece of financial support to pay for the archive storage.
Right.
And very, very minimal running costs, I kept going. And now, look, we've got a film again.
Two films.
And a book again, and we'll see.
Yes, yes. Well, it's a testament to the human capacity to keep on pushing uphill because you believe in something.
Well, it's true, as Celia Farber always says, when you have the knowledge, you can't walk away from it.
Right. Well, some people can.
Can they?
There's always some people who just can't. I mean, one of the things that came up a couple of times during this show was the treatment of pregnant women. And
yeah.
The first case I was really involved with back in the late 90s was the case of Sophie Brassard in Montreal, who was HIV positive, had two HIV positive children.
Yeah.
I mean, it was such a dramatic case. I mean, Sophie was not exactly the easiest person to deal with, but she was doing okay with her children not on drugs, but then one of them came down with a minor throat chest infection or something, and they diagnosed it as PCP pneumonia. She said it was just bronchitis. They started to go after her. You know, she had to have the children on drugs.
Yeah.
Children were taken away from her. She kidnapped her own children. She went to Africa. It was not a good decision. She came back and with a broken heart, I think, and then she died.
Poor
and I just
Sophie.
Saw this whole traffic accident occurring in slow motion in front of me.
How dreadful.
Yeah, and it's hard to let it go when you see what I started seeing as a scientific error. I started to see the human rights aspects on it.
Absolutely. And you've had a lot of work and experience of people in prison, haven't you?
Well, yeah, some, that's the other really big human rights violation. I mean, the first thing is taking children away from their mothers and fathers and poisoning them with drugs like AZT. But then the second thing is usually men, usually heterosexual men who are HIV positive and have sex, and their sex partner says, they didn't tell me that he was HIV positive. In one case in Canada, a man was sent to jail for 21 years and is treated as a sex offender. I mean, the charge in Canada is aggravated sexual assault, which is normally when a man violently rapes a woman, you know, beats her to within an inch of her life and rapes her, that would be considered aggravated sexual assault. But if you're an HIV-positive man and you have consensual sex, it's treated the same. So, I mean, that's another story that needs to be told if you're looking for a new film.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Do you have any ideas for future projects?
Well, for a next project, you mean?
Yeah.
I think the story about what you've just described has to be tackled. And it's a difficult one because people say, oh, well, if you know you're HIV positive and you have sex, then, you know, you're being irresponsible.
There was a case in this case really gets me, because in Canada, most people say, oh, there must be a law against an HIV positive person having sex. But there isn't. It's all done with the laws of fraud.
Oh.
So that if you have consensual sex, if you're HIV positive, a man, and you have consensual sex with a woman, and sometimes the other way around, and then the woman later finds out that you were HIV positive and didn't tell her, that's considered fraudulent consent. And sex without consent is, in Canada, called sexual assault, rape, and other places. And because HIV is conceived of as a deadly weapon, it becomes aggravated sexual assault. Like I said, equivalent to beating somebody with a baseball bat, raping them, and leaving them for dead. So that's kind of the situation. But if you take that to its extreme, you come up with some interesting cases. And there was a case in Israel where a Jewish woman met a handsome young man, and within a very short time, they were having sex. She later found out that he was not Jewish, but Palestinian. And then she charged him with rape, because if she had known that he was not Jewish, she would never have had sex with him. And she won. And he was thrown in jail.
That's extraordinary.
And so you could take... it is an extraordinary case. It was documented in the press. So you could take this, and, you know, a man is in a bar, and he's bragging about how much money he has and all this kind of stuff, and a woman goes home with him, they have sex, and then later... she finds out it was all a big story, and he's broke. I mean, could she then accuse him of not consenting to sex? Or she could say that I would never have consented to sex if I'd known he was poor, and therefore it's now sexual assault. Like, this is absurd. But that's the logic.
Yes. Well,
yes.
I could carry on listening to this, because I'd like to do more research into this, David. So we should.
Yeah, and in one of the states, I think Iowa, they came up with a new law on criminalization that is a little bit more progressive. Yes. It basically makes it extremely difficult to get the most extreme sanctions against a person, because they have to prove that you intended to infect somebody and that you actually succeeded. Which is extremely difficult to prove that somebody intended to do something. Plus, of course, we know that in many cases HIV positive people have sex for years and their partner doesn't become positive. But one of the things they mentioned in that law was, it wasn't just HIV, but it was also meningitis and hepatitis and I believe some others.
I was going to ask about that. Things like herpes and
Yeah, and now, of course, we have cervical cancer is believed to be caused by HSV, human herpes. No, it's not herpes simplex. It's
papilloma.
Yes. HPV, pardon me, human papillomavirus. So is a person who's HPV positive, who has sex without informing their partner, committing the same kind of crime?
Exactly.
I mean, pretty soon we could all be in jail. And and the only way to stay out of jail is to never get tested for anything. Because if you don't know, like if you're HIV positive and you don't know it, then it's not a crime.
Well, this is very interesting because some people are saying a test is a useful marker for HIV, for example. But the advice from the people I interviewed in the film was don't get tested.
Well, all kinds of bad things happen. And you really, it's like many medical tests. I think about it and say to myself, if I was found to be positive, if I was healthy, went to the doctor and I was found to be positive in some way, and I think a cholesterol test. If I went to the doctor and found that my cholesterol was, quote, bad, would I take statins or some other cholesterol drugs? And my answer is no, I wouldn't. So
no,
therefore,
I wouldn't.
Why would I get tested? Because all that's going to happen to me is I'm going to be under a lot of stress.
I know. But here in the, under the National Health Service, there are these targets. They have to test you for everything.
Yes, and you have these bureaucrats who want to measure everything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what was happening. I don't know if you follow this kind of stuff, but in the United States, the head of the Veterans Affairs Administration for Health was fired.
Yes.
But when I listened to him talk, what he was really anxious to do was to set targets for how quickly a veteran would be seen by a doctor and to meet those targets. And the response of his institution was, if we can't meet the targets, we'll just fake the numbers. But I thought, well, maybe the targets are not so great, because in order to meet the targets, the doctor's going to say, oh, you got PTSD, let's put you on antidepressants. Next.
Yeah.
And then they can meet their targets. They can see the veterans in time. And the quickest way to do that is to not, you know, say that you need to talk this out. You need talk therapy. It's going to be depressed, psychotic, whatever. Here's your prescription. Go out, you know, go fill your prescription. You're done. And I think that's a really bad aspect of modern medicine, these so-called targets.
Indeed.
And people are going to be under more and more pressure to have all these tests just so that the doctor doesn't get into trouble because
and then they won't insure him if he doesn't give the tests.
Yes.
The insurance business is incredibly powerful.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I was listening to another American doctor who I think was a physician for Barack Obama at one point, and he said that he's pretty much forced to give the PSA antigen test, the prostate-specific antigen test, even though it's well known that this is completely useless, and all it does, like mammography, is results in over-diagnosis and over-treatment of cancers that are never going to harm anybody. And he said, if I don't do it and one of my patients dies of prostate cancer, I will be sued. So I give what's a useless test, and it's better to have people given biopsies and treatment that they don't need, according to the system, than it is to tell them the honest truth about the test.
Well, I mean, as you know, there's so much money involved that the honest truth about the test is, and people don't, they don't want to believe that. They want to believe that a test is something, you know, a test result they can hold in their hand.
Yes. Well, we could talk for a lot longer about this kind
we
of
could.
Stuff, but I've been told that we're at the end of our show, so I would just like to thank you so much for coming on today and talking about your films, your history as a film producer, and what you might be doing in the future.
Thank you, David, and regards to Gary Nowell. It's an honor to be on your show on his channel, it is, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Joan.
Okay.
Thanks for being on. Bye-bye.
All the best. Bye.